After her awareness of the smell came the almost undeniable sensation of being watched by malevolent eyes. She sensed them studying her nakedness carefully, brooding over it perhaps, marking each undraped curve and line, memorizing the movement of her muscles beneath her wet, sleek skin. "Talk to you up close," the temple seemed to sigh to her beneath the hollow drumming of the rain and crackle of the old leaves beneath her bare feet. "Talk to you right up close. But we won't have to talk long to say the things we need to say, will we, Rosie?" She stopped near the front of the temple and picked up one of the black books from where it lay in the second pew. When she opened it, a gasp of putrefaction so strong it almost choked her wafted up. The picture at the top of the page was a stark line drawing which had never appeared in the Methodist hymnals of her youth. It showed a woman on her knees performing fellatio on a man whose feet were not feet at all, but hooves. His face was suggested rather than actually rendered, but Rosie saw a hideous similarity just the same, or thought she did. He looked like Norman's old partner, Harley Bissington, who had always checked her hem so assiduously whenever she sat down. Below the drawing, the yellowed page was crammed with Cyrillic lettering, unreadable but familiar. It took her only a moment of thought to understand why. They were the same letters which had filled the newspaper Peter Slowick had been reading when she had approached the Traveler's Aid booth and asked him for help. Then, with shocking suddenness, the drawing began to move, its lines seeming to crawl toward her white, rain-wrinkled fingers, leaving little snail trails of sludge behind. It was alive, somehow. She slammed the book shut, and her throat clenched at the wet, squelching noise that came from inside it. She dropped it, and either the bang it made when it hit the pew or her own revolted cry woke a flutter of bats in the shadowy area she supposed was the choir loft. Several of them turned aimless figure eights overhead, black wings dragging loathsomely plump brown bodies through the dank air, and then they retreated back into their holes. Ahead was the altar, and she was relieved to see a narrow door standing open to its left and letting in an oblong of clean white light. "You're really Rosie," the tongueless voice of the temple whispered, bleakly amused. "And you're Rosie Real. Come over here, and I'll give you a great big feel." She refused to look around. She kept her eyes fixed on the door and the daylight beyond it. The rain had abated, the hollow rushing sound from overhead now down to a steady, low mutter. "It's for men only, Rosie," the temple whispered, and then added what Norman always said when he didn't want to answer one of her questions, but wasn't really mad at her either. "It's a guy thing." She looked into the altar area as she passed by it, then quickly looked away. It was empty. There was no pulpit, no symbols, no arcane books. But she saw another hovering manta shadow, this one lying on the bare stones. Its rusty color suggested to her that it was blood, and the size of the shadow suggested that a lot of it had been spilled here over the years. A lot. "It's like the Roach Motel, Rosie," the room whispered, and the leaves on the stone floor stirred, making a sound like laughter slipping between gumless teeth. "They check in, but they don't check out." She walked steadily toward the door, trying to ignore that voice, keeping her eyes fixed straight ahead. She half expected it to slam shut in her face when she got close to it, but it didn't. No capering bogey with Norman's face leaped through it either. She stepped out onto a small stone stoop, stepped into the cool smell of rain-freshened grass, and into air which had begun to warm again, even though the rain had not completely stopped. Water dripped and rustled everywhere. Thunder boomed, but it was going away thunder now, she felt sure. And the baby, of which she had not been aware for several minutes, resumed its distant wailing. The garden was divided into two parts, flowers on the left, veggies on the right. But it was all dead, cataclysmically dead. and the lush greenery which surrounded it and the Temple of the Bull, like encircling arms, made that dead acre look so much the worse by contrast, like a corpse with its eyes open and its tongue lolling. Huge sunflowers with yellow fibrous stalks, brown centers, and curling faded petals towered over everything else, like diseased turnkeys in a prison where all the inmates have died. The flower beds were full of blown petals that made her think, in an instant of nightmarish recall, of what she had seen when she had gone back to the cemetery where her family was buried a month after their interment. She had walked to the back of the little graveyard, after putting fresh flowers on their graves, wanting to collect herself, and had been horrified to find drifts of rotting flowers piled in the declivity between the stone wall and the woods behind the cemetery. The stink of their dying perfume had made her think of what was happening to her mother and father and brother under the ground, how they were changing. Rosie looked hastily away from the flowers, but at first what she saw in the moribund vegetable patch was no better. One of the rows appeared to be full of blood. She wiped water out of her eyes, looked again, and sighed with relief. Not blood, but tomatoes. A 20-foot row of fallen, rotting tomatoes. Rosie? Not the temple this time. This was Norman's voice. It was right behind her. And she suddenly realized she could smell Norman's cologne. All my men wear English leather, or they wear nothing at all, she thought, and felt ice creep up her spine. He was behind her, right behind her, reaching for her. No, I don't believe that. I don't believe it, even if I do. That was a completely stupid thought, of course, probably stupid enough to rate at least a small entry in the Guinness Book of Records, but it steadied her somehow. Moving slowly, knowing if she tried to go even a little faster, she was apt to lose it completely, Rosie went down the 3 stone steps, much humbler even than those at the front of the building, and into the remains of what she mentally named Bull Gardens. The rain was still falling, but gently, and the wind had dropped to a sigh. Rosie walked down an aisle formed by 2 ranks of brown and leaning corn stalks. There was no way she was going to walk through those rotting tomatoes in her bare feet, feeling them burst beneath her soles. Listening to the stony roar of a nearby stream, the sound grew steadily louder as she walked, and when she stepped out of the corn, she saw the stream flowing past less than 15 feet away. It was perhaps 10 feet across, and ordinarily shallow, judging from its mild banks. But now it was swollen with runoff from the downpour. Only the tops of the 4 large white stones which crossed it showed, like the bleached shells of turtles. The water of the stream was a tarry, lightless black. She walked slowly toward it, barely aware that she was squeezing her hair with her free hand, wringing the water out of it. As she drew close, she smelled a peculiar mineral odor coming up from the stream, heavily metallic, yet oddly attractive. She was suddenly thirsty, very thirsty, her throat as parched as a hearthstone. You dasn't drink from it, no matter how much you want to. Dasn't! Yes, that was what she'd said. She'd told Rosie that if she wet so much as a finger in that water, she would forget everything she had ever known, even her own name. But was that such a bad deal? When you thought things over, was that really such a bad deal? Especially when one of the things she could forget was Norman, and the possibility that he wasn't done with her yet, that he had killed a man because of her. She swallowed and heard a dust-dry click in her throat. Again, acting with almost no awareness of what she was doing, Rosie ran a hand up her side, over the swell of her breast and across her neck, collecting moisture and then licking it out of her palm. This did not slake her thirst, but only fully awakened it. The water gleamed a slick black as it flowed around the stepping stones, and now that queerly attractive mineral smell seemed to fill her whole head. She knew how the water would taste, flat and airless like some cold syrup, and how it would fill her throat and belly with strange salts and exotic bromides. with a taste of memoryless earth. Then there would be no more thoughts of the day when Mrs. Pratt, white as snow she had been, except for her lips, which were the color of blueberries, had come to the door and told her that her family, her whole family, had been killed in a highway wreck. No more thoughts of Norman with a pencil or Norman with a tennis racket. No more images of the man in the doorway of the Wee Nip or the fat lady who would call the women at Daughters and Sisters welfare lesbians. No more dreams of sitting in the corner while the pain from her kidneys made her sick, reminding herself over and over to throw up in her apron if she had to throw up. Forgetting those things would be good. Some things deserved forgetting, and others, things like what he had done to her with the tennis racket, needed forgetting. Except most people never got the chance, not even in a dream. Rosie was trembling all over now, her eyes welded to the water flowing past like transparent silks filled with smooth black ink. Her throat burned like a brush fire, and her eyes pulsed in their sockets, and she could see herself going down flat on her belly, sticking her whole head into that blackness and drinking like a horse. "You'd forget Bill, too," Practical Sensible whispered almost apologetically. "You'd forget the green undertint in his eyes and the little scar on his earlobe. These days, some things are worth remembering, Rosie. You know that, don't you?" With no further hesitation, she didn't believe even the thought of Bill would have been able to save her if she'd waited much longer. Rosie stepped onto the first stone with her hands held out to either side for balance. Red-tinted water dripped steadily from the damp ball of her nightgown, and she could feel the rock at the center of the bundle like the pit in a peach. She stood with her left foot on the stone and her right on the bank, summoned up her courage, and put the foot behind her on the stone ahead of her. All right so far. She lifted her left foot and strode to the third stone. This time her balance shifted a little and she tottered to the right, waving her left arm to keep her balance while the babble of the strange water filled her ears. It was probably not as close as it seemed, and a moment later she was standing on the stones in the middle of the stream with her heartbeat thudding emphatically in her ears. Afraid she might freeze if she hesitated too long, Rosie stepped onto the last stone and then up to the dead grass of the far bank. She had taken only 3 steps toward the grove of bare trees ahead when she realized that her thirst had passed like a bad dream. It was as if giants had been buried alive here at some time in the past and had died trying to pull themselves out. The trees were their fleshless hands, reaching fruitlessly at the sky and silently speaking of murder. The dead branches were interlaced, creating strange geometric patterns against the sky. A path led into them. Guarding it was a stone boy with a huge erect phallus. His hands were held straight up over his head, as if he were signaling that the extra point was good. As Rosie passed, his pupilless stone eyes rolled toward her. She was sure of it. "Hey, baby," the stone boy spat inside her head. "Want to get down? Want to do the dog with me?" She backed away from it, raising her own hands in a warding off gesture. But the stone boy was just a stone boy again. If, that was, he had been anything else, even for a moment. Water dripped from his comically oversized penis. No problems maintaining an erection there, Rosie thought, looking at the stone boy's pupilless eyes, and somehow too knowing smile. Had it been smiling before? Rosie tried to remember and found she couldn't. How Norman would envy you that. She hurried past the statue and along the path leading into the dead grove, restraining an urge to look over her shoulder and make sure that the statue wasn't following her, wanting to put that stone hard on to work. She didn't dare look. She was afraid her overstrained mind might see it, even if it wasn't there. The rain had backed off to a hesitant drizzle, and Rosie suddenly realized she could no longer hear the baby. Perhaps it had gone to sleep. Perhaps the bull Arinyes had gotten tired of listening to it and gobbled it like a canapé. In either case, how was she supposed to find it if it didn't cry? "One thing at a time, Rosie," Practical Sensible whispered. Easy for you to say, Rosie whispered. She went on, listening to the rainwater drip from the dead trees and realizing reluctantly that she could see faces in the bark. It wasn't like lying on your back and looking at clouds where your imagination did 90% of the work. These were real faces, screaming faces. To Rosie, they looked like women's faces for the most part, women who had been talked to right up close. After she had walked a little way, she rounded a bend and found the path blocked by a fallen tree which had apparently been struck by lightning at the height of the storm. One side was splintered and black. Several of the branches on that side still smoldered sullenly, like the ashes of a carelessly doused campfire. Rosie was afraid to climb over it. Gouges and splinters and jags of wood stuck up all over the burst trunk. She began edging around it on the right, where the roots had torn out of the ground. She had gotten most of the way back to the path when one of the tree's roots suddenly jerked, quivered, then slid around her upper thigh like a dusty brown snake. Hey, baby, wanna do the dog? Wanna do the dog, you bitch? The voice came drifting out of the crumbling, dry cave of earth where the tree had so recently stood. The root slid higher on her thigh. Wanna put all four on the floor, Rosie? That sound good? I'll be your backdoor man, gobble you like a toasted cheese sandwich. Or would you rather suck my AIDS infected? Let me go, Rosie said quietly, and pressed the crumpled wad of her nightgown against the root that was holding her. It loosened and fell away immediately. She hurried the rest of the way around the tree and resumed the path. The root had squeezed hard enough to leave a red ring on her thigh, but the mark faded quickly. She supposed she should have been terrified by what had just happened, that perhaps something meant for her to be terrified. If so, it hadn't worked. She decided that this was a pretty cut-rate chamber of horrors, all in all, for someone who had lived with Norman Daniels for 14 years. Another 5 minutes brought her to the end of the path. It opened into a perfectly circular clearing, and within it was the only living thing in all this desolation. It was the most beautiful tree Rosie had ever seen in her life, and for several moments she actually forgot to breathe. She had been a faithful attendee of Methodist Little Folk Sunday School back in Aubreyville, and now she remembered the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and thought that if there really had been a tree of good and evil standing at the center of that place, it must have looked just like this. It was densely dressed in long, narrow leaves of polished green, and its branches hung heavy with a perfect bounty of reddish-purple fruit. The falls surrounded the tree in a rose-madder drift which exactly matched the color of the short gown worn by the woman Rosie hadn't dared to look at. Many of these falls were still fresh and plump. They had probably been struck from the tree in the storm which had just passed. Even those well advanced in rot looked almost unbearably sweet. Rosie's mouth cramped pleasurably at the thought of picking up one of those fruits and biting deeply into it. She thought the taste would be both tart and sweet, something like a stalk of rhubarb picked early in the morning, or raspberries taken from the bush the day before they came to perfect ripeness. As she looked at the tree, one of the fruits, to Rosie it looked no more like a pomegranate than it looked like a bureau drawer, dropped from an overloaded branch, struck the ground, and split open in rose-madder folds of flesh. She could see the seeds amid its trickling juices. Rosie took a step toward the tree and stopped. She kept swinging back and forth between two poles, her mind's belief that all this had to be a dream, and her body's equally emphatic assertion that it couldn't be, that no one on earth had ever had a dream this real. Now, like a troubled compass needle caught in a landscape where there are too many mineral deposits, she swung doubtfully back toward the dream thesis. Standing to the left of the tree was something that looked like a subway entrance. Broad white steps led down into darkness. Above them was an alabaster plinth upon which a single word had been carved. Maze. Really, this is too much, Rosie thought. But she walked toward the tree just the same. If this was a dream, it couldn't hurt to follow instructions. Doing so might even hasten the moment when she finally woke up in her own bed, groping for the alarm clock, wanting to silence its self-righteous yell before it could split her head open. How she would welcome its cry this time. She was chilly, her feet were dirty, she had been groped by a root and ogled by a stone boy who, in a properly made world, would have been too young to know what the hell he was looking at. Most of all, she felt that if she didn't get back to her room soon, she was apt to come down with a really wonderful cold, maybe even bronchitis. That would take care of her date on Saturday and keep her out of the recording studio all next week as well. Not seeing the absurdity of believing one could become ill as the result of an excursion made in a dream, Rosie knelt down just beyond the fallen fruit. She surveyed it carefully, wondering again how it would taste, like nothing you found in the produce aisle of the A&P, that was for sure, then unfolded a corner of her nightgown. She tore off another chunk, wanting to provide herself with a square of cloth and succeeding better than she had expected to do. She laid it down, then began to pick seeds up off the ground, placing each one on the cloth she intended using to carry them. A good plan, too, she thought. Now, if I only knew why I was carrying them. The tips of her fingers went numb right away, as if they had been shot full of Novocaine. At the same time, the most wonderful aroma filled her nose, sweet but not flowery. It made Rosie think of the pies, cakes, and cookies that had come from her grandma's stove. It made her think of something else as well, something which was light years from Grandma Weeks's kitchen with its faded linoleum and Currier and Ives prints. Of how she had felt when Bill's hip brushed against hers as they were walking back to the corn building. She laid 2 dozen seeds on the square of cloth, hesitated, shrugged, and added 2 dozen more. Would that be enough? How could she know when she didn't know what they were for to begin with? In the meantime, she'd better be moving. She could hear the baby again, but the cries were now little more than echoey whimpers, the sounds babies made when they were getting ready to give up and go to sleep. She folded the damp cloth over and then tucked the edges in, making a little envelope that reminded her of the seed packets her dad had gotten from the Burpee Company late each winter, back in the days when she had still been a regular attendee at Little Folk Sunday School. She had now grown comfortable enough with her nakedness to be exasperated by it rather than ashamed. She wanted a pocket. Well, if wishes were pigs, bacon would always be on set. The part of her that was practical and sensible realized what she was about to do with her rose matter-stained fingers less than a second before they would have been in her mouth. She snatched them away with her heart pounding and that sweet, tart smell filling her head. "Don't taste the fruit," Wendy had told her. "Don't taste the fruit or even put the hand that touches the seeds into your mouth." This place was full of traps. She got up, looking at her stained and tingling fingers, as if she had never seen them before. She backed away from the tree standing in its circle of fallen fruit and spilled seeds. It's not the tree of good and evil, Rosie thought. It's not the tree of life, either. I think this is the tree of death. A little gust of wind puffed past her, rustling through the pomegranate tree's long, polished leaves, and they seemed to rattle out her name in 100 small, sarcastic whispers. Rosie, Rosie. She knelt again, wishing for live grass, but there was none. She put down her nightgown with the rock inside it, placed the little packet of seeds on top of it, then snatched up big handfuls of wet, dead grass. She scrubbed the hand which had touched the seeds as well as she could. The rose matter stain faded but didn't disappear completely, and it remained bright beneath her nails. It was like looking at a birthmark which nothing will completely bleach out. Meantime, the baby's cries were becoming ever more occasional. Okay, Rosie muttered to herself, getting up. Just keep your damn fingers out of your mouth. You'll be all right if you do that. She walked to the stairs which led beneath the white stone and stood at the head of them for a moment, dreading the darkness and trying to nerve herself up to face it. The alabaster stone with maize carved into its surface no longer looked like a plinth to her. It looked like a marker standing at the edge of a narrow, open grave. The baby was down there, though, whimpering as babies do when no one comes to comfort them, and they finally set about doing the job as well as they can themselves. It was that lonely, self-comforting sound which finally set her feet in motion. No baby should have to cry itself to sleep in such a lonely place. Rosie counted steps as she went down. At 7, she passed beneath the overhang in the stone. At 14, she looked over her shoulder at the white rectangle of light she was leaving behind. And when she faced forward again, that shape hung before her eyes in the screening darkness like a bright ghost. She went down and down, bare feet slapping on stone. There would be no talking herself out of the terror which now filled her heart, no talking herself through it, either. She would be doing well just to live with it. 50 steps, 75, 100. She stopped at 125, realizing she could see again. That's nuts, she thought. Imagination, Rosie, that's all. It wasn't, though. She raised a hand slowly toward her face. It and the little packet of seeds it held glowed a dull, witchy green. She raised her other hand, the one holding the rock and the remains of her nightgown beside it. She could see, all right. She turned her head first one way, then the other. The walls of the stairwell were glowing with a faint green light. Black shapes rose and twisted lazily in it, as if the walls were actually the glass faces of aquaria in which dead things twisted and floated. Stop it, Rosie, stop thinking that way. Except she couldn't. Dream or no dream, panic and blind retreat were now very close. Don't look then. Good idea, great idea. Rosie dropped her eyes to the dim X-ray ghosts of her own feet and resumed her descent, now whispering her count under her breath. The green light continued to brighten as she went down, and by the time she reached 220, the last step, it was as if she were standing on a stage lit with low-level green gels. She looked up, trying to steel herself for what she might see. The air down here was moving, damp but fresh enough, yet it brought her a smell she didn't much like. It was a zoo smell, as if something wild were penned up down here. Something was, of course, the bull Erinyes. Ahead were three freestanding stone walls facing her edge on and running away into the gloom. Each was about 12 feet high, much too tall for her to see over. They glowed with that sullen green light, and Rosie nervously examined the four narrow passages they made. Which one? Somewhere far ahead of her, the baby continued to whimper, but the sound was fading relentlessly. It was like listening to a radio which is being slowly but steadily turned down. Cry! Rosie shouted, then cringed from the returning echoes of her own voice. Hi! 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 Nothing. The four passages, the four entrances to the maze, gawped silently at her like narrow vertical mouths wearing identical expressions of prissy shock. Not far inside the second from the right, she saw a dark pile of something. You know damned well what that is, she thought. After 14 years of listening to Norman and Harley and all their friends, you'd have to be pretty stupid not to know bullshit when you see it. This thought and the memories that went with it, memories of those men sitting around in the rec room, talking about the job and drinking beer and talking about the job and smoking cigarettes and talking about the job and telling jokes about niggers and spicks and taco benders and then talking about the job a little more, made her angry. Instead of denying the emotion, Rosie went against a lifetime of self-training and welcomed it. It felt good to be angry, to be anything other than terrified. As a kid, she'd had a really piercing playground yell, the sort of high, drilling cry that could shatter window glass and almost rupture eyeballs. She had been scolded and shamed out of using it around the age of 10, on the grounds that it was unladylike as well as brain-destroying. Now Rosie decided to see if she still had it in her repertoire. She drew the damp underground air into her lungs all the way to the bottom, closed her eyes, and remembered playing Capture the Flag behind Elm Street School or Red Rover and Texas Rangers in Billy Calhoun's jungly, overgrown backyard. For a moment, she thought she could almost smell the comforting aroma of her favorite flannel shirt, the one she wore until it practically fell apart on her back. And then she peeled back her lips and let loose with the old ululating, yodeling cry. She was delighted, almost ecstatic, when it came out sounding just as it had in the old days. But there was something even better. It made her feel the way it had in the old days, like a combination of Wonder Woman, Supergirl, and Annie Oakley. And it still affected others as it had back then, it seemed. The baby had begun to cry again, even before she had finished sending her schoolyard war whoop into the stony dark. It was, in fact, screaming at the top of its lungs. "Quick now, Rosie, you have to be. If she's really tired, she won't be able to manage that volume for very long." Rosie took a couple of steps forward, eyeing each of the four entrances to the maze, then walked past each of them, listening. The wail of the baby might have sounded a bit louder coming out of the third passageway. That could have been no more than imagination, but at least it was a place to begin. She started down it, bare feet slapping on the stone floor, then halted with her head cocked and her teeth working at her lower lip. Her old war cry had stirred up more than the baby, it seemed. Somewhere in here, how close or far away was impossible to tell because of the echo, hooves were running on rock. They moved at a lazy lope, seeming to grow closer, then fading a little, then growing closer again, then somehow this was more frightening than the sound itself, stopping altogether. She heard a low, wet snort. It was followed by an even lower grunting sound. Then there was only the baby, its bellows already beginning to subside again. Rosie found herself able to imagine the bull all too well, a vast animal with a bristly hide and thick black shoulders humping grimly above its dropped head. It would have a gold ring in its nose, of course, like the Minotaur in her childhood book of myths. And the green light sweating out of the walls would reflect off that ring in tiny stitches of liquid light. Erinyes was standing quietly now in one of the passages ahead, its horns tipped forward, listening for her, waiting for her. She walked down the faintly glowing corridor, trailing one hand along the wall, listening for the baby and the bull. She kept an eye out for more droppings, too, but saw none, not yet, anyway. After perhaps 3 minutes, the passage she was following emptied into a T-junction. The sound of the baby seemed slightly louder to the left. Or do I just have a dominant ear to match my dominant hand, she wondered. So she turned in that direction. She had taken only 2 steps when she stopped short. All at once, she knew what the seeds were for. She was Gretel, underground, with no brother to share her fear. She went back to the T-junction, knelt, and unfolded one side of her packet. She placed a seed on the floor with the sharp end pointing back in the direction from which she had come. At least, she reflected, there were no birds down here to gobble up her back trail. Rosie got to her feet and began walking again. 5 paces brought her to a new passage. She peered down it and saw that it divided into 3 branches just a short way up. She chose the center branch, marking it with a pomegranate seed. 30 paces and 2 turns later, this passage dead-ended in a stone wall upon which 7 black words had been slashed. "Wanna do the dog with me?" Rosie returned to the 3-way junction, stooped to pick up her seed, and laid it at the head of a new path. She had no idea how long it took her to find her way to the center of the maze in this fashion, because time quickly lost all meaning for her. She knew it couldn't have taken terribly long because the baby's cries continued, although by the time Rosie began to get really close, they had become intermittent. 2 times she heard the bull's hooves go thudding dully along the stone floor, once at a distance, once so close that she stopped short, hands clasped between her breasts as she waited for it to appear at the head of the passageway she was in. If she had to backtrail, she always picked up the last seed, so she should suffer no confusion on her way back out. She had started with almost 50. When she finally came around a corner and observed a much brighter green glow straight ahead, she was down to 3. She walked to the end of the passageway and stood at its mouth, looking into a square, stone-floored room. She glanced out briefly, looking for a roof, and saw only a cavernous blackness that made her dizzy. She looked down again, registered several more large pats of dung scattered across the floor, and then turned her attention to the center of the room. Lying there on a pad of blankets was a plump, fair-haired baby. Her eyes were swollen with crying and her cheeks were wet with tears, but she had fallen quiet again, at least for the time being. Her feet were in the air and she appeared to be trying to examine her toes. Every now and then she gave out a watery, sobbing little gasp. These sounds moved Rosie's heart in a way the baby's all-out wails had not been able to do. It was as if the infant knew somehow that she had been abandoned. "Bring me my baby." Whose baby? Who is she, really? And who brought her here? She decided she didn't care about the answer to those questions, at least not now. It was enough that she was lying here, perfectly sweet and all alone, trying to comfort herself with her own toes in the chilly green light at the center of the maze. And that light can't be good for her, Rosie thought distractedly, hurrying toward the center of the room. Must be some kind of radiation.